Well, happy primary election day Tuesday. Welcome to Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge in for Craig Blumenschein over the next couple of weeks. Now, if you are a Beatles fan, you are going to totally geek out later on in the program because our own Todd McDonald talks with May Pang. You might remember she had a 2-year relationship with John Lennon that saw him not only having a quote-unquote lost weekend, but reconnecting with his Beatles bandmates and son Julian. May served as kind of a muse for John Lennon. Plus, she's an accomplished photographer, and believe me, she took a lot of snaps, and some of them are being exhibited and even sold today and tomorrow at the Underbrush Gallery in downtown Fargo. You'll get a little closer to the Fab Four later on in the program. But first, on this primary election day here in North Dakota, we thought we'd check in with one of its most celebrated politicians. He served 3 terms in the U.S. Senate and was elected 6 times to the U.S. House of Representatives, and the airport terminal in Grand Forks is named after him. Senator Byron Dorgan, welcome back to Prairie Public's airwaves.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Well, we are talking to you on the occasion of primary election day here in North Dakota. Is there anything that you miss about the ritual of running for office here in North Dakota? Like, what was your routine on election day?
On election day, well, at that point, you know, the travel is pretty well done. You've done a lot of lunches and banquets and a lot of small towns and big towns. And at that point, you sort of exhale a little bit and kind of wait and see what the vote looks like. The old Claude Pepper, you know, one of the oldest members of the U.S. House from Florida, he used to describe this act of voting as the miracle in the Constitution. It's when the American people grab the steering wheel. And when they grab the steering wheel by casting their vote, they decide what's the direction of the country, who leads our country. And it's such a great, important day to be able to get out and vote. I hope everyone decides to get out and cast their ballot.
Yeah, Americans are taking the wheel today, and, you know, will in November, of course, as well. And there's so much national debate and divide over our elections today and election integrity. How do you see America's most sacred ritual, voting and the right to it, surviving this moment and surviving what some see as threats to it?
Well, there is a threat to this country in a number of ways. I won't go through all of them, but we have 3 branches of government, and there's a lot going on in the country that is enormously troublesome to me and I think to a lot of people, but we'll get through it, and the American people just need to cast their vote and decide which direction they want America to move. This is a very important election now, North Dakota and around the country, when we have the opportunity to cast that ballot.
Well, another big occasion, another sacred occasion, is less than a month away in Medora, North Dakota. Of course, around the country, too, but here in North Dakota, we're celebrating America's 250th birthday with the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. We're hearing that maybe some A-list guests will be there, perhaps people with the title of president. What about your presence? Are you planning on heading out there? And what do you think of this political moment in the national spotlight for North Dakota?
Well, I think it's a big, big deal. I will not be there, unfortunately, but I will get there at some point soon and see what has been done. You know, it's really interesting. The people that began thinking about this came to me when I was a U.S. senator, and they said, any chance that you could provide some funding, and I did that under the Appropriations Committee, I said, yeah, I'll do it, some funding to digitize the Roosevelt records that existed in the Library of Congress. And digitalizing those records then allowed them to be, at this point, in Dickinson, North Dakota, and now over to the Roosevelt Library. This goes back some long way. They've had a long, lengthy dream about doing this. Teddy Roosevelt came to North Dakota and lived in North Dakota for a period of time. I think everybody understands that on a certain day of the year, his wife and his mother died in the same home in New York City. And on that day, he drew a big X in his calendar, wondering whether he would make it through all of these times, and he decided to go out to North Dakota, and he did. He moved to North Dakota and became a rancher.
And he always credits North Dakota as being instrumental in him being a president of the United States. Now, I know that you have been moved by the plight of Native Americans, particularly Native children, so much so that you wrote a book, The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America, about a child's heartbreaking story, which for those that are not familiar, you read about this in a newspaper and thus sort of began an odyssey of trying to locate her and sort of trace and document the systems that left her so vulnerable. You did a lot of work on Indian affairs. You were chairman of a committee in Congress. You created a nonprofit to help Native Americans. There's even a sports facility in Belcourt named after you. How has this country reckoned with one of its gravest sins, kind of inarguably, the treatment of Native Americans, or has this country at all?
Well, we haven't done well at all. You know, there are two real significant stains on our history. One is slavery, and the other is how we treated those who were here first, Native Americans. And, you know, some land has been stolen from them over time. The treaties have been ignored. So it's been a tough time, and that's one of the reasons I've cared a great deal about it. You know, when you see injustice, it seems to me you have to stand up and deal with that injustice and respond to it. And I know that all Native Americans, and I've worked with a good many of them, all of them across the country, care very much about trying to get this done and get it done the right way. So we'll see. Much, much more should have been done and still can be done for Native Americans.
Senator Byron Dorgan, we're talking to him from Washington, D.C. today. He joins us on the phone. Senator, you got into political life pretty young. In fact, you became, what, the youngest constitutional officer in North Dakota? But it was under a cloud of tragedy. Could you kind of take us back for those who don't know that story?
It really was. I left North Dakota to get a master's degree and was working out of state. But I came back to North Dakota to visit a guy who, or someone who asked to visit with me when I came back from my grandfather's funeral. I went up and talked to a fellow who had just won statewide election at age 38, a remarkable guy. And he said, why don't you come back to North Dakota to the state capitol and work with me? And I did. I was inspired by him, and I moved back to work with him. And he, a year and a half after I moved back, this was a great tragedy. He took his own life in his office. In fact, I found him at 8 o'clock in the morning. And it was a very tragic thing. And I, you know, he was a mentor of mine, a friend of mine, and so it took some while to get through that. The governor called me down about 6 weeks later. I was 26 years old. And the governor said, you know, I have watched you a lot. I think you have something significant for our state and for our country. I think you have the capability to do some important things. And I'm going to nominate you. I'm going to send you an appointment to fill that term. So at age 26, I was state tax commissioner. And then I ran for that office and again. And I ran for the House six times, ran for the Senate three times, and then I decided to retire. And, you know, it was a very strange situation that sort of began with tragedy. But I got through all of that, and as a result of it, I felt enormously privileged to be able to serve in the Congress. And let me just tell you, coming from a high school senior class of, I think, 9 students, to then sit for 18 years on the floor of the United States Senate, in a desk that was my desk. It's quite a move from a town of 300 people, a desk in a high school there, to a desk in the United States Senate. I've never forgotten what how important it is and how privileged I have been. And can I just tell you a story about the desks very quickly?
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. I think I know where you're going. Yeah. Go ahead. Yes.
Well, when I left the Senate, you carve your name inside the desk drawer that you pull out. And so my name is in a desk drawer in the United States Senate, says Senator Byron Dorgan. Mm-hmm. My first desk, you know, when I got it, I pulled out the drawer to see who had sat in that desk. And it said, Harry Truman sat in that desk. The whole series of names. I thought, oh, my gosh, here I am from this tiny little town in North Dakota, and I'm sitting at Harry Truman's desk. And then I saw Robert La Follette, the great populist from Wisconsin. The desk behind mine, two rows, was John F. Kennedy's desk, and then Robert F. Kennedy's desk, same desk, Ted Kennedy's desk. It's just remarkable to be sitting in that chamber, and, I've never, ever felt when I was there that this wasn't something very special, that I was very advantaged to be able to do it.
Well, and it's almost like you're filling in somebody's shoes that couldn't fulfill his career in politics in a way. It's almost like a tribute to him. Do you see it that way?
Well, yeah. He was a remarkable guy. He was a guy that he came from a town of 80 people in North Dakota. and then he graduated from Harvard Law School. So just think of that, you know.
Wow.
And he came back at age 38, was elected statewide, and a remarkable person. I've always missed him, and I've always felt a great tragedy that he took his life.
Well, it just all speaks to, you know, the opportunities that we have in the United States of America at 250 years old, that, you know, people could come from such humble beginnings and, you know, do something very significant with their lives.
And, you know, I mean, our country, we talk a lot about what's wrong, but, you know, our country is quite remarkable. We've spliced genes, we've split the atom, we've cured polio, we've cured smallpox, we learned how to fly and sent someone to the moon 66 years later. You know, all the things that this is a remarkable place, and we tend, I think, too often to talk about what's wrong. It is important to understand what we need to fix, but it's also important to understand how terrific this great country is.
Mm. We're talking with former Senator Byron Dorgan here on Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge. Glad you're with us today. Now, Senator Dorgan, you got out of politics in 2010, and some said at the time the writing may have been on the wall that now Senator John Hoeven was leading you in the polls, but you contended back then, and some others agree, that, yeah, you could have beaten him. How would you have beaten him should you have chosen to run? And how can Democrats get back in the prominence today in North Dakota and, more importantly, to earn back voter trust?
I don't know. I don't think those who bet against me were going to cast a very good bet because I was very successful both in the state capitol and also the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate over a long period of time. And, you know, you could, I guess they could bet on someone else, but I don't think it'd be a particularly good bet. But, you know, the fact is I had been in public service for a very long time, and I wanted to do other things. I've written 5 books. I'm in the process of working on another book. I went to teach, did some teaching at Georgetown University as a professor over there for 5 or 6 years. And so, you know, I've just been doing a lot of other things, which I wanted to do and was not able to do while I was in the Senate all those years. There are some people that felt, well, why would you in your 60s not run again for a re-election? Well, because I was wanting to do other things, and there are plenty of other things to do that are exciting and interesting, and so I decided not to continue. But I've even having said that, I've never, ever thought that it wasn't a spectacular opportunity for me and for our state.
Hmm. Well, today, Senator Dorgan, voters in North Dakota go to the polls, including in North Dakota's largest city, Fargo. And even though that's a nonpartisan race for mayor here, Democratic State Senator Josh Boshay has a chance to win. And some see him as a rising star in the party. Have you got your eye on any politicians or potential Democrats that could break through and perhaps earn statewide or maybe even national office from North Dakota in the future?
Well, he's terrific, and I hope people have the opportunity to see that and evaluate that and make that vote. But this is like a clock, you know, one of these clocks where the pendulum swings back and forth. There was a time when Democrats controlled the state house, controlled the governorship for 12 years under William Guy, and then 8 years under Art Link. And the fact is that things will change, but it takes some time, and that pendulum swings back and forth. There is one party rule in North Dakota now. That's not good for our state. And my hope is that both political parties have the opportunity to have majorities in the future. Things like drug pricing, being fair to family farmers with respect to a wide range of cost increases they've been forcing, the energy issues with respect to wind energy and so on, really important issues that aren't really being discussed very effectively in our state at this point. I hope that'll change.
Yeah, certainly with energy, I think the pendulum has switched back to coal-fired plants, and I know you've been a champion of that, and carbon capture, some of the things that Doug Burgum used to sort of tout, but now it just seems instead of all of the above, it's, you know, including wind and solar, it's just sort of weighted back to coal and fossil fuels.
I'm very surprised. I mean, North Dakota is producing over 1 million barrels of oil a day, and I was supportive of opening up in North Dakota to get that accomplished, you know. But the fact is, it's important for us to care about other things like wind energy and so on as well. And I'm a bit surprised by the Interior Secretary and the change that he has apparently experienced in some of these things. But We'll see. Let me go back to the issue of drugs. This country still has not dealt with the effective price, the highest effective price for brand name drugs of any place in the world. And I've worked on that and worked on it for the longest period of time. The drug industry has a great deal of money, and they pushed back, and they've generally been successful. But, you know, I've taken a busload of North Dakotans to Canada, where you could buy the same drug for a third of the price or a fourth of the price. It's unbelievable. There are things like this issue still need to get done. We need to keep fighting to get them done at some point.
No, I joked with you earlier that you were back in office when Democrats roamed the earth in North Dakota, and far from prehistoric times or anything, but the 90s and early aughts seemed to me like a lifetime ago, at least in statewide politics. You, Senator Kent Conrad, and Representative Earl Pomeroy all had D's by your name. You mentioned one of the chambers in Bismarck was Democratic. How did you achieve that trifecta? I mean, North Dakota has always been kind of a right-leaning Republican voting state. How did you achieve that back in the day? It just seems almost implausible.
Well, first, let me tell you how outstanding Kent Conrad and Earl Pomeroy were. I mean, they're terrific public servants. So that's the first and most important thing. But I think most North Dakotans would ask the question, do I know this person? Do I like this person? Do I trust this person? If the answer to that is yes, they don't care so much what side you're on or what tribe you say you're part of, because I think most people know that someone who cares a great deal about our country is going to care much more about our country than they are about our political party. And so the three of us, I think for almost two decades, served exclusively North Dakota in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And I think North Dakotans, a good many North Dakotans, will look back and think that was a pretty significant time with great opportunity. But we'll see. As I said, the clock ticks, and that pendulum swings back and forth, and it'll come back once again.
Well, it just seems like, aside from the very North Dakota thing of going out and pressing the flesh, going to every town, shaking hands and getting people to know you and like you, there's a challenging media environment, both traditional and especially digital media, that just would make it, I would think, hard if you're not the party in majority power to even crack that ceiling.
The thing that I find interesting is that I did town meetings all across North Dakota all the time, in small towns and big towns. I mean, I just was all over doing town meetings. And almost no one who serves in the House and the Senate from North Dakota now is out doing town meetings. Almost no one. And that's surprising, because the way you find out how people feel about things is to go out and listen and have a visit with people. And town meetings have been critically important, at least in my service in North Dakota. And I really hope that those who represent North Dakota in the Congress now will decide that they want to hold these town meetings and would begin getting out and holding three or four on a weekend.
I think maybe they're afraid of the optics of getting booed. could be part of it.
I don't know. I just don't know. But issues in the U.S. Senate in the last couple of days, the issues about a $1.8 billion fund to pay people that were weaponized, including people that were trying to beat up cops and break into the U.S. Capitol. You know, I mean, people will ask about, how did you vote on that? And so many others as well, building a billionaire ballroom, tearing down the East Wing of the White House and building a billionaire ballroom that they said was going to be paid for privately. It was never approved, of course, but it's going to be paid for privately. And then they tried to put $1 billion in the appropriations for the ballroom. So there's so much that needs to be answered by people. And I hope they'll get out there and hold town meetings and say, here's how I voted and here's why I voted that way.
So when you were in office, you often talked about the late Senator John McCain and your many works across the aisle, Senator Dorgan. In the hyper-partisanship times that we're in, where it seems to be only about winning and sticking it to the other party, but also during a time when voters demand that you work together, that Congress work together. These things are kind of coexisting at the same time. Can they? And how does government function without turning into the gridlock?
Well, I miss John McCain a great deal. John was a really terrific American and a great senator. And incidentally, some while ago, somebody asked me a question about this, and so I I typed into YouTube, John McCain and Byron Dorgan, just the two names, and up popped about a 30-minute debate that John and I were having, on the same side, on drug pricing on the floor of the United States Senate. And it is fascinating. If anybody would like to pull it up and see it, I think you would enjoy it. You'd enjoy hearing John and also my approach and trying to do what we can do to reduce these drug prices. You're supposed to be working across the aisle to find out what are the best ideas. And unfortunately, these days, it's all tribal. It's all whose team are you on? What team are you a part of? Instead of deciding, all right, what's the best idea here? What is the best thing we can do to advance this country's economic and advance this country's interest in so many other areas?
You are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. If you're just joining us, welcome. We are talking with former U.S. Senator from North Dakota, Byron Dorgan. Now, I do want to mention that Joe Biden, former President Joe Biden, is back in the news with his wife Jill Biden's memoir out. And it makes me think of something that you have written about, how President Biden was there for you during a terrible time in your life. And it got me to thinking of that when you mentioned Theodore Roosevelt and the tragedies that he was trying to escape from and come into North Dakota to get some healing from it. Can you share that story with us for those that don't know it?
Sure, but let me just say, I wish Joe had not decided to run a couple of years ago, but he did decide, but I wish he had not, because I thought he was going to be a kind of a transfer, and he'd be there 4 years with a great record, and he did have a great record, but at any rate, Joe is a friend, and let me tell you the short story. Joe lost his wife, and I think daughter, in a car accident. And he's been through a lot of tragedy. And so my 23-year-old daughter, Shelley, died during heart surgery. Supposed to be very routine, and it wasn't. And I guess no heart surgery is, but we spent days and days and days in intensive care. And my daughter didn't make it, and she died. And I was sitting in the cloakroom one night later, maybe 2 weeks after Shelley died, and I was kind of over in the corner by myself, just sort of staring at the wall. I was trying to figure out, how do I get through this? I mean, it was horrible. And someone tapped on my arm, and I turned around, and it was Joe. Mm-hmm. And Joe said to me very quietly, he said, I know what you're thinking. I know what you're going through, because I've been through that. And he said, you know, just always understand, as you move forward, there's a purpose, and you'll get through this, Byron. And I've never forgotten that moment. Just because, you know, it just made all the difference in the world to me to have somebody come up to me who's been through that. And so that's my story about Joe. I like Joe a lot, but I wish he had not said that he wanted to run for presidency for another term at age 82. That was not the right thing.
Thank you for sharing that story, Senator Dorgan. Now, I feel like I should, while I have you, take an opportunity to ask you about the situation today in Cuba, which by most accounts is pretty dire as far as what it's like on the ground there. There's a warrant out for Raul Castro, I believe, for murder, basically. Now, you were always for easing embargoes and opening up travel to Cuba. You sponsored bipartisan legislation to ease those restrictions. What are your thoughts on the island today?
Well, I feel today like I did previously. The restrictions and the embargo has never worked. We've had it for 50-some or 60-some years now. You can travel, for example, to China, a communist country. You can travel to Vietnam, a communist country. Well, Cuba is a communist country. We've had this long embargo. The only single change in the embargo was an amendment I got passed that allowed us to ship some beans from North Dakota to Cuba. And Cuba had to pay cash, and the cash had to be through a European bank. And so I think I just got a little crack in the armor with respect to what we have done with respect to Cuba, but I have never felt that approach has solved the problem. I would much prefer more people be able to visit Cuba. Now, I'm not a big fan of Fidel Castro or Raul Castro. They're dictators. But I also know what is happening today is dramatically hurting the Cuban people. They don't have lights. They don't have energy. They don't have medical equipment. Fidel Castro never missed a meal because of this embargo. But I'll tell you what, a whole lot of the Cuban people missed meals and missed a lot of other things as well.
Well, bringing it back to your home state, Senator Dorgan, you were born in Dickinson, but as you mentioned, you grew up in tiny Regent, North Dakota. For those that are not familiar with your lovely town, what was it like growing up there? What do you miss about your hometown?
Well, you're right. I was born in Dickinson, North Dakota at St. Joseph's Hospital, and they took me back to Regent. I think it's a town of, it was about 280 people or so. I've been back there, and it's a small town, a wonderful town. I think three churches and two bars, and two tiny little grocery stores. One was called the Co-op store that everybody owned, and everybody in town knew everybody else. That's just a fact. And as I told you, my dad was a horseman, and he was a terrific horseman. He loved horses more than most anything. And Regent, North Dakota, like so many other North Dakotans, was a wonderful town. The difficulty is this. Most kids go to high school, graduate from high school, and then they're gone. And they don't come back because there aren't jobs in Regent. And that's true of a lot of hometowns, small towns. But I come from a hometown I'm enormously proud of. I was always proud to tell people, here's where I'm from, Regent, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And it's just a great pleasure to be able to say I graduated, you know, in a high school class of 9 senior students. Always felt pretty good about having done that. And you're never far from the top 5 or the bottom 5 when you're in 9.
That is true. That is very, very true.
That's right.
Well, I'm sure I could tell you've taken the Regent, North Dakota values with you to Washington, Senator Dorgan. Former Senator Byron Dorgan is a New York Times best-selling author of 5 books, including Take This Job and Ship It, How Corporate Greed and Brain-Dead Politics Are Selling Out America, and the eco-thrillers Gridlock and Blowout. And gosh, we haven't even had time to talk about those, Senator. Maybe we'll take a rain check on that. But thank you so much for your time on this primary election day. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, it's kind of the most bipartisan sentiment in the world to say, go out and vote today, right?
Absolutely. Grab that steering wheel. That's what America's about. Self-government. The people decide who's in charge. Just the people.
Senator Dorgan, it was a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Really good to be with you. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages. And by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2026 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org. You're listening to the Main Street on this primary election day Tuesday. I'm Eric Dethridge. Speaking of that, our news team will be live blogging tonight, so check it out at prairiepublic.org. They'll have their eye on the race for U.S. House of Representatives, Public Service Commission, and for parents, Superintendent of Public Instruction. Again, check it out tonight at prairiepublic.org. You're hearing the music of David Bowie in the background, but on guitar, and background vocals for the song Fame was one John Lennon, and his time with photographer May Pang that famously led to what was called a lost weekend out in Los Angeles, where John Lennon spent some time in a romantic relationship with May Pang, but it also inspired John Lennon quite a bit, and it helped him reconnect with his family, namely his son Julian, and also his ex-Beatles bandmates. May Pang is in Fargo today and tomorrow to exhibit a collection of photographs of her time with John Lennon. The exhibit is called The Lost Weekend. Our own Todd McDonald was lucky enough to have a chat with her. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up after this hour's news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starion Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starion, taking you farther. Learn more at starionbank.com.
You are listening to Main Street here on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge for Craig over the next couple of weeks. Well, May Pang, if you are a Beatles fan, you know that name. She was John and Yoko's personal assistant back in the early 70s, around 1973. Yoko Ono and John were going through a tough patch in their marriage, and supposedly Yoko encouraged a romantic relationship with May Pang and John Lennon. They went to Los Angeles, had a lot of fruitful times out there. Some say it was a lost weekend, but it blossomed into nearly a two-year relationship. Well, May Pang, she took a lot of photos, candid ones, of John Lennon during that time. She is in town in Fargo at the Underbrush Gallery today and tomorrow. That's on 25th Street South in Fargo. The exhibit called The Lost Weekend of Photography of May Pang is happening today, Tuesday through 7 p.m. So if you're listening to the rebroadcast, you'll have another chance tomorrow between 1 and 7 p.m. to catch the exhibit. Our own Todd McDonald drew the lucky straw, and he has this conversation with photographer May Pang.
This is May Pang. And I can't believe I'm here in Fargo. I'm thrilled.
There are places I remember.
You know, it's been great. This is the 87th show that we're doing here.
This show features what many remember as a Beatle, John Lennon.
Yes. They call it the lost weekend during my period. But when you come in, you see pictures of him, photos that I've taken for just us, and you'll see that it's not so lost. It's just a phrase that was used. And he said to me, you know, people are going to think it's about us, but it's not really about us. Because, you know, people were saying, well, you know, you were drunk, you were out of it. He wasn't drunk, he wasn't out of it. He had a couple of incidences, but, you know, who hasn't been out with their friends and ripped up the town? But guess what? He's the one that's going to be known for it. Because if you're going to put a copy out and you say, Harry Nilsson ripped up the town, or John Lennon ripped up the town, who's going to make the better copy? And that's really what happens.
And Harry Nilsson got to put it in his documentary, too.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not as famous as every time that John goes out. And, you know, and it's the same, you know, things that happen. The press, the media keeps repeating the same thing, so it sounded like he was, you know, always drunk, but he wasn't. And you could see it in the photos.
Let's get a little history here. You were working for the Beatles at Apple Corps.
Well, I actually was working at Apple, and at that point, Alan Klein, who was the manager, had acquired Apple Corps and everything that was going on. And I got a great music lesson, and that was really, especially in music publishing, which I love. And then I got a chance to work on the publishing for this little-known group called the Rolling Stones. Yeah, so it was a little bit of everybody, and then Apple Publishing, and then three out of the four Beatles, too. Really, how it started was really working for John and Yoko. It was funny because they came into town, and next thing you know, my phone's ringing at my desk, and they said, they're in town to make two movies, and they need people, and you're it. You're one of them. And I said, me? And the two movies were shorts that Yoko had an idea for. One was called Up Your Legs Forever. She wanted 365 legs of different people, pairs of legs, to shoot them in that sense from your toes to your thighs and donate for peace. And the other one was called Fly. And that was about watching a fly crawl all over this woman's body. And getting flies in the dead of winter was not easy. That's all I'm going to say.
I hate to jump to the chase right away, but this developed into a romantic relationship.
That's something that happened in 3 years later. So, yes, it did happen. I did not want it, but it was Yoko who came into my office to ask me, not to ask me, to sort of say, I think you should go out with him, and because we're not getting along, and I'm going, but I don't want to. Maybe, you know, somebody else, but not me. And she goes, no, you'll be good for him. She goes, you know, you don't want him to go out with somebody that's not going to be nice to him. I said, I'm sure not, but I'm not it. And John didn't know what was happening either, which we talked about later. And so this was something that Yoko was doing her thing. And I think that's where I always will say, if you get a chance to watch my movie, it's called The Lost Weekend, A Love Story. It's right now, it's on Prime, if you have Prime. It's on Tubi, it's on Roku, and it's on Apple TV, on YouTube TV. Just, you know, watch it. It also gives you context about all the photographs I have.
When it comes to this, you're working at a talent agency, you're working at Apple Corps. How do you not get starstruck in a place like this?
After you work for a while for these people and you're working 24/7, it's no longer as glamorous as the first 10 minutes. You start working. I mean, when I started working for them on a permanent basis for John and Yoko only, I mean, it was 24/7. I even wrote down, I saw a notebook that I had written down some stuff, and I'd written down where they were supposed to go out for dinner, and they were having it with the Secretary of the United Nations at the time, U Thant, and I had down, tell them they'll be at the table with him, and then 3 would be something else, and about 5-6 items down, and I see one of the items I said in there was, I had written, ask for a day off. So I don't think it becomes that glamorous that after a while, you know, that you're starstruck. I think you're starstruck for that first few minutes, you know, when George Harrison would walk in to come see him in 1971, or Bob Dylan. That was a little exciting, you know. But then I walked away. I'll tell you, the most exciting was when John said to me, and they were staying at the St. Regis Hotel, and he goes, I want you to go upstairs, and can you ask if Fred Astaire would come down? And I said, Fred Astaire? I was starstruck there because he was my idol. And when I was growing up, I loved Fred Astaire. So I got a chance to meet him.
Your pictures of the Lennons, the whole family, got at some very intimate moments.
Right. It was, you know, because John liked the way I would take photographs of him, and I didn't know that. I would just take photos, and he would say, let me see what you've taken. And I'd show him the pictures. He goes, oh, they're not bad. And I would say, okay. And he said, yeah, carry on. And he goes, you don't make me look fat. And I looked at him. I said, what do you mean? He goes, oh, I hate photo sessions because, you know, in the old days, I just look fat, and I don't like the way I look. But I do like the way you take the pictures of me. And I realized, you know, I look at it from a different point of view than a lot of these photo sessions. So none of my photos, they're more intimate. They're just about us. And that's really what it was about.
Yeah. Having that level of access,
yeah,
you know, just that you're walking by and you see John, you know, relaxing on the couch. And your eye catches it. I mean, first of all, you have a very talented eye. But
thank you.
To have that ability, what kind of freedom does that create for you as an artist?
I think it's I didn't understand it at first. Because, you know, for me, I'm taking a photograph because I think it's a great shot. But the idea that he gave me the freedom is amazing, because I really thought any moment that he's going to shut me down and said, don't take this. But he just let me do what I want. And that really is it's something that I cherish, you know, that he allowed me to do that.
To have that carte blanche.
To carte blanche, exactly. Yeah. And every place we would go, he goes, mate, get your camera out. He relied on me to have my camera with me all the time. I remember one of the photographs, it was Ringo standing there, and it was to announce one of the people at Apple going to be installed in L.A. And he said, oh, too bad we don't have a photographer here. We should have had it. And John just turned and looked at Ringo and Tony King and said, look, we do have a photographer. And I'm standing there with my camera, not realizing he's talking about me. The thing is, it's the trust. I was always a trust. I'm not taking these photos to sell them. It was, at the time, it was, and, you know, he would say, go for it anyway. And later on, he used to say, do whatever you want.
Was there a shot that he did not like? Did he ever censor you?
He never censored me. Never. He always allowed me to take whatever shots. And you could see, including the one, I think the one of, there's a picture, it's called Soup's On. And it's a picture of him eating his favorite soup as he's watching television, his favorite pastime. And it was afterwards, it's his hot and sour soup. So his nose is running, and he starts blowing his nose, and I'm taking photographs, and he's looking at me like, really? He just laughed at it later.
But also access to the family, the children.
Yeah, there was only really one at the time. It was Julian, and Julian, it was the first time he had seen his son in 3 years, and I wanted, there were some great shots of him and Julian, father and son. They hadn't been together, and it was just moments. It was just that moment in time that they get a chance to be together, and I wanted those moments captured. So we were on a boat. They could swim. I couldn't. I thought, you know what? You guys go out there. I'll just take photographs when you get back on the boat. But I took pictures of John laying in the water. He loved all that. He just loved being in the water.
In the so-called Lost Weekend, yeah, you mentioned it wasn't just all the depravity and drunkenness. There was a meeting, a small reunion of two Beatles.
We saw Ringo all the time in L.A., and we saw Paul and Linda when we were out there. And this was early 74. The end of March 74, we saw him, came out. And then when we were back in New York, there's also one of those myths that they thought we lived out in L.A. We actually lived in New York, but we did, different things, projects. We would fly out to L.A., but we never lived there. We would borrow houses from people. One of our first houses, I was John's lawyer. When we landed in L.A., he said, okay, where are you going to stay? And I said, Harold. I didn't get that far because, it was John decided he wanted to go to L.A. And he said, okay, you'll stay at my place. So we stayed in his apartment in West Hollywood. And we stayed there and we felt guilty. And we ran into, on one of our nights out, we ran into Andrew Oldham. Andrew Oldham was the original producer, manager for the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
And so we said, Andrew, what are you doing here? He goes, oh, I'm about to leave. I'm staying in Lou Adler's home. And they're still good friends to this day. He said, why don't you stay there? I'm sure Lou will let you. He goes, let me arrange it. And it was because of him. He arranged us to stay in Lou Adler's home in Bel Air. And so there's a couple of shots of that, when we were there that I took. And then after that, we stayed in the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. And the only other place we stayed after that was when we were doing Harry Nilsson for his project, his album, Pussycats. He rented the house in Santa Monica, which was once owned by Peter Lawford. And it was great because I got a chance to see Peter about a day or so after we all moved in. And it was at a party at his home, his new place in Hollywood. And I said, Peter, I got to tell you something. And he goes, what? I said, Harry rented a house in Santa Monica. And they looked at me with this look. And he goes, and I said, it's on Pacific Coast Highway. And he just sat back. He was on the floor, his knees to his chin. He had a cigarette in his hand. He took a puff. He let it out. And all of a sudden, I look across his face and he goes, some good times. Some really good times. I mean, you can't get anything better than that from, so things like that happened.
Yeah. In that span where you were the photographer, what photos did you not get to take?
Maybe I didn't get a chance to take more of one with George. That was towards the end of the year. I didn't do the one with George. I do have a photo of George. It was my very first photograph of a Beatle in my collection. And it was at the office at Apple in New York. And he was in town in November of 70. And he had just come in with Patty. It was for All Things Must Pass. And he was coming in to do it for, the U.S. release. And he saw me with the camera. And he was so gracious. And he said, come on, let's take some photos. That was my very first photograph. And then a couple of weeks later, there's one of John holding, that one's up, and that's with him holding his Dr. Pepper. And that was a couple of weeks later. So those were the only two, the first two photographs I've ever taken of the Beatles, or, separately. And it was in 1970.
And another photo, famous for you, is the the signatures on the disbanding of the Apple Corps.
Yeah. What people don't realize is when the lawyers brought in, it isn't just one slice piece of paper, and it isn't that that says, oh, it's over. There was a lot of agreements to be signed because they had assets. People forget. It's not just them, but it was also what they owned, what they agreed upon. So it was a stack. And I remember John yelling for me going, now, come in here now. I need you to take some photos. And I'm like, oh, I'm just wondering if Julian's okay. So my mind was split. But I did manage to take something, and it was in such a dark room. I wasn't sure if I even got the shot because I didn't have, just my camera. I didn't have a light for it or anything, so I did everything manually.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. I do like film. I do like the idea that I was taking, I probably was using a Tri-X 400 at that point just to get that shot. But the darkness around it lends to the photograph. And I didn't even know what I had until much later and realized I caught John in his hand mid-signature signing the thing.
You bring these photographs to Fargo. What do you hope people take away?
I want them to see the John I saw, which was a fun-loving guy. Not the things that were in the press where he was having fun with his mates, as I would say. These photos are really more from my private collection, my time with him, that we spent the time together, and I think he would want that. He would always want people to see him in a light that nobody expected. And he was really having a great time, him and Julian, things that, with his other friends, and the quiet moments. Put a smile on people's faces. I've seen a lot of tears because they've never seen him look like that. And you will see him smiling on a lot of the photos.
All right. Well, two-day show. It opened on Tuesday.
Yes.
Word to the wise, get here soon.
Get here soon, absolutely. Because it's only Tuesday, Wednesday here, and then I head off to the next town.
Yeah, and you're doing, I was talking to Scott, this is a classic bar band tour. You're going from Minnesota into North Dakota, and then you're just keeping following I-94.
Yes, I'm going to Billings, Montana next, and I've never been to these cities. So it's all new for me, but the next trip is going to be a long one, 8 hours in a van. You may see me wave to you out there, I'm enjoying it, really, to see the people, meeting them. It's great.
We appreciate you sharing your vision, your eyesight, what you've captured on film, and just the emotion.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that, when people come in, they can purchase these limited prints, and they could take him home so they can see him how I saw him.
That was Prairie Public's Todd McDonald in conversation with photographer May Pang, who is showing her photos of John Lennon at the Underbrush Gallery on 25th Street in Fargo. Today till 7 p.m. and tomorrow from 1 to 7, that's on 25th Street, the Underbrush Gallery.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 9th. Printed in large quantities on cheap paper, dime novels were widely popular. Costing just a dime, and sometimes only a nickel, they were aimed at a broad audience. The first recognized dime novel was published on this day in 1860. Maleska, the Indian Wife of the White Hunter, is the story of an interracial marriage set in the Catskill Mountains of New York State. Dime novels that followed were often set in the American West and shaped perceptions of the frontier for people who would never see it for themselves. The books romanticized life on the frontier, portraying it as filled with adventure and heroism. Cowboys and Indians, outlaws and lawmen became familiar, if exaggerated, figures. Dakota Territory was depicted as a wild and unsettled land full of danger. Dime novels relied on stereotypes such as heroic pioneers, independent cowboys, ruthless outlaws, and hostile Indians. The stories needed a notable villain, so the West became populated with cold-blooded desperados. Countering the evildoers were brave cowboys and fearless lawmen. The pioneers who ventured into an unknown and unsettled land were portrayed as strong and steadfast. Dime novels introduced an unwritten Code of the West that required cowboys to be loyal and honest. Fact and fiction began to blur together. Dakota Territory became a character of its own, with sweeping vistas and endless prairie. When Buffalo Bill introduced his Wild West show in 1883, he pulled dime novel characters out of the books and presented them in a live show, further cementing the stereotypes in the American imagination. The cowboy became an American icon. The cowboy, lawman, outlaw, and settler were transferred from the pages of dime novels to movie westerns and 1950s television. Characters like the Lone Ranger, Marshall Dillon, and the Boys of Bonanza became weekly visitors in American homes. The Wild West was never as wild as portrayed. Gunfights were not as common as movies and television shows would have us believe. Many towns had strict gun control laws. Far from being romantic, the life of a cowboy was lonely, dirty, and dangerous. We can thank dime novels for cementing the stereotype of the Wild West in the American imagination. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
All right, that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'm Eric Dethridge. I will chat with you tomorrow. And if you haven't already, please go out there and vote.